Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Now, I'm delighted to say that on the Chatteroo, we have someone who I can only describe as progressive royalty. Is that one way of describing you, Wilhelm?
Progressive royalty. I mean, I really don't know what to make of that one.
he is a brilliant thinker, an outstanding advocate, and an incredibly nice bloke, and my really good friend. And he has written a really, really interesting and worthwhile and important new book. Will Hutton, thank you so much for joining us.
It's a pleasure to be here, Ed. And thank you, Jeff.
And, you know, honestly, for those who know Will Hutton well, he was only 15 minutes late to this interview, which is sort of remarkable. Now, the book has got a very intriguing title, which you told me about some months ago, and I really was sort of quite taken aback. The book is called This Time, No Mistakes, How to Remake Britain. I did say to you the other night, because I happened to run into you at the Arsenal game, were you talking about Arsenal when you said This Time, No Mistakes?
And they didn't make it.
But you were talking about Arsenal.
that was before 5-0, wasn't it?
Talk to us about why the book is called This Time, No Mistakes.
Well, there are two targets with that title. I mean, the overwhelmingly important target is really the whole body of ideas. I don't know whether your listeners are going to across laissez-faire economics or free market economics. And they were pronounced dead by my intellectual hero, John Maynard Keynes, 100 years ago, actually, in 1924. New life was breathed into this body of ideas by Mrs. Thatcher. And, I mean, the basic notion is that it is the individual and her, his choices and preferences that should be placed at the centre of the economic universe, free market, social universe, there's no such thing as society, and moral universe, individualism and the pursuit of your individual interests. And we all know that credo. And actually, with the interlude in fairness of New Labour, who didn't do enough, in my view, to kind of break it, but at least kind of held it at bay for a period, we've lived through a series of catastrophes. One was Mrs. Thatcher's monetarism, which led to literally a halving of manufacturing employment in 10 years, with scars that are still with us today. And all those areas of the country affected voted for Brexit 30 years later. Then she launched Big Bang, financial deregulation, which culminated in the great financial crash of 2007-08 that you lived through, Ed. Then the same principles were applied by George Osborne and David Cameron for the austerity, with the incredible cuts in public expenditure. And then the same thinking was behind Brexit, which I regard as another first-order mistake. Those four catastrophes were capped by Liz Truss doubling down on the same thinking with a 49-day excruciating premiership And no country can survive mistakes of that magnitude without reeling, and we are reeling. So this time no mistakes is really what I'm about, bringing down the curtain on that thinking. But it's also a message to the liberal left that actually we didn't do a good enough job in taking it on and demonstrating to the British public that actually as a body of ideas it just didn't work. And so part of it is kind of aimed at not just the Labour Party, but actually the body of ideas that supports the Labour Party and kind of all the people who are inclined to vote for it. So this time round, really strike out in a different direction.
And given that the mistakes you identify, those specific mistakes, all happened under Tory governments, is conservatism the mistake and the left's failure to course correct? Or is there something specific to British conservatism?
Very good point. There is a kind of respectable kind of one nation, kind of accepting in a sense the philosophy of the post-war settlement. Harold Macmillan, who wrote, I think, a really interesting book, as radical in its way as The State We're In or This Time No Mistakes, which I wrote back in the day, who really got it, you know, that you can't build a strong society.
That was his book, The Middle Way. For those who don't know, that was his book, The Middle Way.
Yeah, The Middle Way, yes. I beg your pardon, I should have said. I mean, in working on This Time No Mistakes, I always known of it, but I hadn't bothered to read it. And I was really taken aback by its embrace of Keynesian economics, by its insistence that you had to reform the City of London from top to bottom, that actually there was a case for repurposing the principles on which British capitalism, British firms were operating on, for recognising trade unions, for organising a universal welfare state, for ensuring that every family in the country should have basic levels of nutrition. Many Labour thinkers, even now, would not go as far as Harold Macmillan in 1938. So, I mean, there is a conservative tradition which isn't ruinous. But what happened, I think, was with Mrs. Thatcher, and was that she'd imported too much from the rise of the American right. I mean, Ayn Rand and that libertarian kind of philosopher novelist, really, putting the individual and greed at the centre of the moral universe, but in the form of a novel. Donald Trump says that the only novel he's read is Atlas Shrugged, in which there's a man called John Galt who makes the world bend to his imaginings and ravings, which is rather what Donald Trump has done with election denying and the storming of the Capitol on January the 6th. That in a way is Ayn Rand playing itself out. So I do think that the British right has bought into that big time. Liz Truss, in particular, has bought into that. You know, taxation is coercive and a burden and immoral. Regulation, similarly, any constraint on the individual is pernicious. All of that is rooted in this excessive embrace of individualism, and that's what I want to try and push back on.
Now, there's so much to talk about. As I read the book, I'd say it's a sort of twin track set of things that need doing, and I think, in fact, you say this almost pretty explicitly in the conclusion, which is taking on a sort of failing economy, reforming a failing laissez-faire economy, and reforming politics.
Yeah, there's a triple objective.
And the third objective?
Well, essentially, I think, you know, strong economy, strong society, are kind of effective, democratic, agile state are all kind of part of the same story. But you're right.
So let's just talk about each of those. What would it look like, or what would the key priorities for you be in bucket one? So reforming laissez-faire capitalism.
First and foremost, I'd want to hardwire into the DNA of every company and firm, from small to kind of gigantic, kind of British-owned multinational, that it should write into its foundational articles of association that its purpose is the pursuit in one dimension or another of societal benefit, of human betterment, from which it will set out to make a profit. That actually that's the right way round to think about the way in which a company has an obligation to society, as a society kind of has reciprocal kind of obligations in a sense to kind of wealth generators, but it's a reciprocal kind of relationship, not, you know, that we should kind of bow down and say, oh, thank you, great companies for doing business in our country. They have to earn a license to operate. So that's the first thing I would do. I do think, in parenthesis, by the way, and we should talk about this, there's been an epidemic of stripping of our companies with great technologies over the last 20 years, which is just astonishing. It's an untold story. And one of the reasons why that's happened is that too much of our capitalism is based on simply transactional relationships and having to kind of look for exits and big money, rather than to think about pursuing a great purpose over time. Secondly, I do think to get any dynamism in an economy, you have to do two things. It has to be public investment led. And we'll discuss how that can be financed in a second. But I think the targets for that are levelling up, the drive to net zero and decarbonisation, R&D, and an infrastructure. The state, if it gets serious about public investment of that type, and then manages to kind of coordinate and integrate and match its spending with private business that is itself purposed in the way I've described, and lastly, is equipped with the financial wherewithal, patient, clever capital behind it, so that it too can make the investments on the scale that's the counterparty of what the state is doing. If you get those three things right, you will get the economy moving.
Just to go to the other bucket, the democratic bucket, you make an interesting point. By positioning themselves or having the optics of the natural party of government, the Conservatives are in a position where their ideas become the hymn sheet that everybody feels they have to sing from to a greater or lesser extent, when in actual fact, in a first-past-the-post system, those ideas have never had a majority support. So talk to us a little bit about the ideas for how you fix that.
I'm very struck when you look at British politics since the foundation of the Labour Party in 1900, and you could even go back to the Third Reform Act of 1885, when really modern British politics and kind of the modern economy really got going. It's just been, as you say, Jeff, consistently the story that any division in the progressive vote in a first-past-the-post system lets the Conservatives in. And that was well understood, by the way, kind of in the 1880s, 1890s, and early decades of the 20th century. I mean, there was a huge debate. There was a commission in 1908 on proportional representation, which recommended a single transferable vote. In the Parliament Act of 1918, there were huge debates about whether or not the system should be proportional representation. And really, it was Ramsay MacDonald who thought that first-past-the-post would make Labour the second party of the state, who resisted an introduction of PR. And I think that was a category error. As you say, I mean, 1951, Labour wins the popular vote by some margin, actually, and yet has a minority of seats in the House of Commons because their votes are all concentrated in the industrial areas and not spread around every constituency in the country. So time and time again, that's been the case. So it could have been Labour who actually got the rewards for the post-war settlement turning out as successfully as it did in the 1950s. It could have been a Labour leader who could have told the British public we've never had it so good, because it was essentially Labour policies that had produced that boom, although it could have been better still. Equally, you know, in 1929, had the Liberals, who were more Keynesian than actually a rather timid and pragmatic Matt Ramsay MacDonald and Philip Snowden, had they had the kind of representation in the House of Commons that they should have done, there could have been a British New Deal. There's a lot of Labour backbenchers kind of were with Keynes and Lloyd George. So time and time again in our history, and again, you know, Mr. and Mrs. Thatcher should never have won in 83. I mean, the Liberals as they were, and Labour had a substantive majority over her, but it wasn't reflected in the House of Commons. So time and time again, and I've come round to the view that actually, it may be the case, by the way, that single first past the post will now benefit Labour, because I think the Tory vote is divided between Reform and the Conservative Party. We saw it in the kind of some of the kind of election that was just kind of at the end of last week. I want to live in a civilization and a democracy where actually kind of the streams of opinion are reflected in the House of Commons. And you can design it kind of so you have to have minimum thresholds so that 5% or 10% of the vote you have to reach before you get representation in the House of Commons. But you can still have MPs relating to their local constituencies and it topped up portions of parties in the House of Commons in the way that was done in London Assembly elections and is still done in Scotland and Wales. It would be a much better way of running our affairs and a much better democracy in which to live.
Now, I think you've hinted at it in this answer, which is this book is not just a critique of conservatism, it's a critique of mischances by the Labour Party. And I want to sort of get you to reflect on that a little bit. Nearly 30 years ago, you wrote the best-selling book, The State We're In. You've written a number of other books since, but maybe this is in some sense the sequel to The State We're In, because it's a potentially, we don't know, but it could be a similar political moment. You are quite critical in the book of the new Labour government. Just to quote you, you said it was a duck-and-weave administration looking for points of least resistance. Blair wanted to be all things to all men and have the political space to retain the Thatcherite economic model. Now, one part of me wants to ask, is that fair, minimum wage, for example? But more importantly, why do you think your book, which was a bestseller and all that, didn't get adopted as you would have wanted it to have done by the last Labour government? And what lessons do we learn from your belief that it didn't adopt your agenda in the way you'd have wanted?
Well, it didn't adopt his own agenda. I visualise a world of ethical socialism and progressive liberalism. Great thinkers like Keynes and Beveridge came from the progressive liberal tradition, and great thinkers like Richard Tawney and Evan Durbin came from the ethical socialist tradition. And I argue for fusing it. So you provide both a floor and a ladder. And
actually, so why didn't it happen?
Well, it should have been happened because Tony Blair himself wrote that philosophy into the Labour
Party. I know, but why didn't it happen? I mean, you must have a view on why it didn't happen.
I do have a view on why it happened. I think it didn't happen because it looked as though the economy didn't need it, that actually the Thatcherite settlement had delivered growth and Labour could spend the growth dividend on improving public services, which did, in fairness, did work for a period. Secondly, I don't think that people might kind of utter those words of ethical socialism and progressive liberalism, but when it came to the push, actually building institutions or taking on the vested interests that implied, Labour shrank from. You know, it was happy enough taking on trade unions, not less happy taking on the kind of barons in the City of London. Thirdly, I think there's a kind of Labour has got two things in its kind of DNA. It's redistributionalist, good, and it wants to promote the worker interest, good. But it doesn't have a kind of a third thing in its DNA. It's wanting to put its kind of open the bonnet of capitalism and start thinking about how to make it function better. How can you make banks lend to it against intellectual property? How can you get startups to scale up? How can you make capitalist firms want to engage with their workforces? What drives innovation? What kind of institutions would drive innovation? There isn't a kind of hinterland of kind of thinking in the Labour Party about that.
Look, what's interesting about the book is, this is kind of what I wanted then to come on to, is you don't just talk about what you perceive to be the failure of New Labour. You talk about your frustrations about the 1964-70 government, about the 1945-51 government, about the 1924 government, not the end of 1924, in case anyone was wondering, and about the 1929 government.
Yes, I do.
Now, there's a pattern here which you identify. Now, you can either think the pattern is to do with the fact that the people around at the time didn't do the right things or whatever, and, you know, maybe that's, you know, might be partly true in some cases. But isn't there a deeper question here, which is, if a capitalist economy is oriented and built in a particular way, it's very hard to change it. And I think this is one of the things you identified in the answer you just gave, because of the set of interests that there are that don't particularly want to change it. So I want you to sort of draw out the implications, not just of what you perceived about New Labour, but also like 100 years of Labour history where they haven't done what you wanted.
Yeah. Well, I mean, look, you know, I think it was astonishing. I mean, look, why did MacDonald and Philip Snowden in 1929 try to make the gold standard work? Why did they try it? Why were they so resistant to what major trade union leader like Ernest Bevin was saying? What kind of the founder of ICI was saying, kind of Alfred Mond, what a little progressive business and bankers were saying, that this isn't going to work, you know, what Keynes himself was saying. Well, after all, was a Cambridge intellectual and hardly a kind of Bolshevik. It's as MacDonald that said when, you know, the national government was formed, every duchess in Mayfair will be toasting us tonight. There's been that tension throughout, a kind of desire, as you say, to please the powers that be, without recognising that actually the powers that be, or that you imagine the powers that be, are themselves kind of asking the same fundamental questions that you are. You know, the idea that British business is a kind of monolith that just wants less taxation and less regulation and that's like the blue touch paper is just not true.
I mean, but isn't that interesting? I was going to come on to this. Isn't that interesting that I was going to ask you, this is a point of optimism. Isn't British business in quite a different place than they were 30 years ago when The State We're In was published?
Absolutely. No, I've been very, very struck by that. I've been very struck by that with my work in a little think tank I run called The Postal Company, where lots of businesses kind of help us kind of inquire into the role of purpose in business and want to put it front and centre. People are very concerned about the languishing stock market. People are very concerned about the way not a day goes by almost without some fabulous high-tech British company and being taken up usually by American private equity and re-domiciled kind of in the United States. It's a kind of tech stripping on a monumental scale. And people are very concerned about it. I mean, there are 50 companies in the last 25 years that have been taken out in that way, that had they remained in the UK as self-standing companies, would have populated the FTSE 100 and made it the high-tech stock market in the world. And instead of which, our stock market's gone from number 3 to number 10. And if you're an investor...
You're saying that sort of failure to reform capitalism is bad for capitalism, basically.
Absolutely. And actually, the capitalists themselves are keenly aware of it, or the ones who think are. There's a committee now in the City of London under the chairmanship of the chief executive of the Stock Exchange, Julia Hoggart, who are really investigating how to kind of reform the capital markets in ways which I kind of were thinking about 25 years ago, and I was regarded as a kind of deadly Bolshevik who kind of should be, you shouldn't touch with a barge pole. And actually, kind of some of the leadership of the Labour Party thought that at the time, as you know. But, I mean, you know, it's there for all to see. I mean, the per capita living standards in the UK are really languishing. We're a country in headlong decline. Median incomes, medium household incomes are lower than Slovenia, for Christ's sake. Strip out London and the southeast, and per capita incomes are lower than the poorest American state, Mississippi. We're not living in a country that's flourishing particularly. And people who run business, they can see what's going on. They want change, basically.
What is striking, the area I'm working around, climate and energy, some of the most progressive voices are from business that are wanting to go further, faster, etc. And it is very striking.
Well, that's exactly what I mean, Ed. I mean, I know that fossil fuel companies get it in the neck, but you'll find members of the board or members of the senior executive who recognise that 25 years on, they're going to have to kind of rebuild the business model around sustainability.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
We'll be right back.
Can I ask you to reflect on one thing, which is you talk quite a lot in the book about the United States, partly about Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal, and then you talk a little bit about Biden, and it is very interesting if you talk to the people in the Biden administration that they represent a different strand of progressive thinking, either from the Obama administration or the Clinton administration, the role of trade unions, the role of public investment, the role of industrial strategy. Why is it that the US, which is a country that is suddenly not seen as a sort of social democratic in any sense, why is it that both with the New Deal and now with Biden, there's been more of a turn to these ideas?
Great question. My view is that there's part of the business establishment, a financial establishment in the States, which actually gets it. I mean, at the moment, I mean, I think many people in Silicon Valley understand the role of, you know, universities and big Pentagon defense research contracts as being stimulative of capitalist dynamism. So they kind of get that. I also think the Democratic Party is a thinking party. There's lots and lots of very good think tanks and progressive think tanks. You know, substantial intellectual effort is made into exploring.
Is there also is there also something here, which is, as the Democratic Party never had aspirations to quote unquote abolish capitalism,
quite,
it made it easier to be a party that was kind of credible reformers of it.
That's exactly right, and that was going to be my third point. I mean, the Labour Party, had it been founded around a credo of ethical socialism and progressive liberalism, which, by the way, people were arguing for at the time, but instead of which it threw open its doors to...
So you here. You weren't there either.
No. But it threw its doors to kind of all comers. And actually, doing that, it never kind of... It was never going to socialise the means of production. I mean, Sidney Webb's Clause 4 in 1919, the Soviet Union was about to happen. It looked as if communism was a doctrine of the future. But it was such a mistake. And the one thing which I do think Tony Blair was 100% right on was rewriting Clause 4 in the way that he did and trying to kind of say to the Labour Party, for Christ's sake, you know... we are a reformist party around socialist or ethical socialist principles, but we're not going to transform capitalism into socialism. And actually, if you can leave that one behind, a gentleman called Ralph Miliband, was kind of in despair that actually a reformist kind of political party in a democracy like ours was never going to achieve socialism in our time. But I always thought that was the wrong exam question. The honest, kind of honest recognition is to understand the kind of philosophic undergirdings of socialism. We're always about kind of blending the we and the I, and thus by so doing, to give everybody a better shot at living a life they had reason to value. I mean, that's the essence of it. And that I think the Democratic Party has got in the United States, which we haven't got in Britain. Maybe we're going to get it. I'm optimistic that actually Keir Starmer, the Labour leadership, which includes you, Ed, do get it. You know, frankly, Clem Attlee got it. I mean, I know that, you know, it's all regarded as a great socialist government, the 45-51 government. It did lots of nationalisation, blah, and all the rest. But its ideas were still informed by Keynes, a new liberal, Beveridge, a new liberal, Beveridge alongside Nye Bevan, an ethical socialist, putting two fantastic reforms in front of the British people on the same day. If Clem Attlee understood that perfectly well. So, you know... it's there to be done. There is a coalition to be built with actually British business and finance who know now that there has to be some kind of state-led effort in partnership with business and finance to put the British economy back on its feet. There's a Labour Party that actually, I think, doesn't want to make the same mistakes again. And there's a British right that has actually collapsed into a kind of confederation of conflicting cults. And so consequently, it's a moment. It's a really important moment.
Can I just finish by asking you about your intentions as a writer? Because when you write a book like this, or the state we're in, you're not writing a pamphlet as the head of a think tank. You're writing a book of political thinking for a mainstream audience. Now, of course, you're hoping, as was the case people felt about the state we're in the 90s, that perhaps it offers some kind of roadmap for an incoming Labour government, and maybe we're at that point in history again with this book. But what are your intentions for the general reader? Policymakers are only a tiny fraction of the people who will buy your books. What do you hope that the general reader will take away from it? Will they act upon something? What will it do for them?
Reasons to be hopeful. I mean, I do think that change, it comes from the bottom-up demands that actually kind of leaders can lean into. And so what I'm trying to do with the book is to create some kind of mood music, create argument that readers can pick up and run with, and maybe persuade other people that kind of there's reasons for hope. And it's also trying to kind of hearten thinkers, hearten intellectuals, help other writers. It's, you know, I want to be part of a, and I think I am actually. I mean, it's not the only book of its type that's been published in the last kind of few months or going to be published in the next few months. There is a kind of tide. I'm only a pebble on the beach, but I want to be the more pebbles there are on the beach, the more change we may get.
Okay. Well, look, ideal beach reading, Will Hutton, this time, no mistakes. How to Remake Britain, coming soon to beaches and AU. Will, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers. With rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's Stamps.com. Code PROGRAM.